Hey folks, it's that time of year again where we ask you to do a survey for the Amp Hour. This really helps us to figure out what's going on with our audience and what's working and what isn't working. And we just love hearing from you as well. So if you're interested in participating, we'd love to hear from you. There is a link and the actual embedded survey over on theamphour.com, the show notes for this page. For those of you who do fill it out, we'll have some prizes, DMMs, and Analog Discovery 2s, and some custom Amp Hour lab notebooks that we had made a while back. So be sure to put in your email. That's the only way we can get a hold of you. And don't worry, whatever you say in the survey does not impact your ability to win, and we won't use your email for any other marketing purposes. Thanks a lot. This is the Amp Hour Podcast. Released October 13th, 2019. Episode 462. Boat Anchors.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
Daylight saving again.
Yeah, every four times a year or something.
Yeah. It's right. Like, I wake up this morning and because the kid alarm didn't go off and I'm late for my recording the Amp Hour, and then I message Chris and
Usually it's the other way around. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, we changed the other week. It's good. I like it.
Yeah. Well, welcome to it, man. Welcome to it.
It means every time I leave, it's still light, you know? It's like when I leave here to go home, it's like, yeah.
I'm not a big fan of daylight savings myself.
Right.
I think it's better to... But if you really ask me, I'd be like, well, let's just all be on UTC, you know?
Right. All right.
Yeah.
What do we got this week? Where have you been? What books have you read?
What books have I read? We didn't even talk about this before the show.
Oh, God.
I have been reading Eccentric Orbits, which I think I mentioned on the show before, because actually someone tweeted about it. We talked about it on episode 460.
Obviously, I remember it vividly.
I got a terrible memory. But I have been reading it, and, you know, it's great. It's, let's see. So I must have mentioned it 2 weeks ago. Oh, that was only 2 weeks ago. So I must have mentioned it then, but it's kind of crazy how much strife there was to make sure that thing didn't go down in a ball of fire. So
what thing are we talking about?
Sorry, the 66 satellite constellation of Iridium.
Right.
So cost $6.2 billion by Motorola, and those guys were a-holes. they just sounded like a company that was on its downslide. You know?
Right.
And we did talk about this 2 weeks ago because
I now live in the shell of
that corporation's
building.
But
that's right.
Anyways, it's interesting too because I've been working on some satellite based stuff for work, and it's an interesting like interacting with stuff that's it just doesn't seem like it should work, honestly.
Right.
Yeah. Have you ever done anything like that or no? Like any remote.
Not remote stuff. In the military stuff and things like that, underwater comms and stuff like that, but it's not really the same,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, shorter range comms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's
tough when you're like in the middle of nowhere. And it's interesting too, because like reading the historical context of Iridium, you know, that was really targeted. Like they're like talking about like, oh, we want to like get the business traveler and like the, you know, every high end business traveler will have
one of
these.
Yeah.
Even though it didn't work inside, even though like it, you know,
really,
it had
I thought it was pretty good. From what I gather, people liked it and it was pretty good, but it was just, I don't know, like not economically viable or something.
It was very, very expensive. Like because of all the politicking that had to happen, like each call that you made. So like say you were traveling to the States, would go through, you know, even though you're talking to a satellite, it would then go bounce back down to where you come from. And then it would be handled by the U.S. and then it'd be patched over the landlines.
No. You know? So there were geopolitical issues with it.
Tons and tons. That's also how they raised all the money. So like, yeah. I won't spoil the book too much, but it's
okay.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's Yeah, it's crazy.
It's a wonder it ever got off the ground. No pun intended.
Right. I mean, like, to Motorola's benefit, I mean, they were pretty much one of the only companies that could have done it because they had the technical expertise, but they were just massive. And it's really hard for me to get a sense of scale. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's like that other book that we talked about in the past, the Bell Labs book, I forget what that was called. But, you know, like thinking about Bell Labs and like all of the telephony stuff, like even earlier than Motorola, like just the effective monopoly and then like what that does for the scale of things you can build is pretty amazing.
Imagine if a startup tried to do the same thing. You wouldn't get anywhere. Unlike, say, you know, like you would think like a startup rocket company would be harder, right? There's, you know, SpaceX and lots of other startup rocket companies, right? Private rocket companies. And you'd think that'd
be
harder.
I don't want to cut you off too soon here. We've actually had someone on the show that did a communications hybrid.
Obviously wasn't there.
Yeah, okay. You weren't there. It's fine. But I mean, like, but the scale is much smaller, and I think we're so much further down the line.
But yeah, right. I'm talking about an entire satellite.
Yeah, like a constellation of multiple satellites.
Constellation and designing the phones and the whole thing, right? And you would think that rockets would be harder, but it's not. You simply hire a big space, lots of smart people, throw a lot of money at it, you build a rocket, and then you just apply for a permit to launch it, and Bob's your uncle, right? And it either works or it doesn't. And you either get more funding or go bust. But I don't know
if I'd say a rocket's easier, but
No. But I'm talking from the ability to actually produce a finished product and get into the market. Whereas designing your own phones and satellite systems and launching them and getting all the approval and the red tape and all the geopolitics and everything, that would be a lot harder for a tiny little tin pot company to do.
I think a lot of it is tied to the time frame, right? I mean, like they were just inventing technology to then go and launch it into space, right? Yep. You and I and everyone listening, we all benefit from that. Like you can go out and you can buy an Iridium modem.
Yeah, of course.
Like it's still, it was saved and
who's operating it now? Is there another, is it a Iridium consortium or something?
No, it's an Iridium corporation. So the whole book is about saving the company. It gets last night I was reading for like 2 hours and it's very lawyery at a certain point, which was surprising.
Right.
Like it's just like back and forth and like the fact that they have all the like who said what to whom, and it was very, very interesting. But the fact is they saved it in order to then go and target the industrial market, and that's you know the kind of stuff that I think other people would use. Like if you're in the middle, so like say you're like in the middle of like I don't know. Like Kansas, right? With like nothing around. It's just wheat fields all around you, corn, wheat, whatever, right? Like there's no cell towers. Like it's not like you have elevation, you know? Like at a certain point you get to like where you just can't. You literally cannot do anything otherwise. You either got to go and try and do a bounce, like an ionosphere bounce, like ham radio or something, and you can't operate in that obviously as a company. That's an amateur band. But, you know, you got to do something like that, and it's... you know, and then you start running into like curvature of the earth problems. You just run out of options. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I wish those flat earthers were right. You know, it would be so much easier.
Yeah, you just crank it up to 10 kilowatts and then you're good to go.
You could do the entire planet, yeah.
It does make you wonder, like, what are they... You're like, okay, like, so why isn't your signal getting past 19 miles, you know?
Have you seen the documentary? Have you seen the Flat Earther documentary?
Is that the one where the guy was going to like, do the self-launch rocket? I remember, like, I think we talked about it.
No, I don't think that was in it. No, that was it. No, there's a Netflix special. I can't remember what it's called.
Okay.
But it is, hang on, I'll call it up. But it is hilarious. Okay. It's like, I thought, no, there's no way I'm watching that. Yeah. But it is great. It's just
the mental gymnastics you have to do in order to really do this kind of thing. Mark
Sargent, who is the king of the flat earthers, he's actually doing television ads in Australia now.
Oh really? Wow.
I think it's for cell phones actually. I think it's ironically.
That's great.
Yeah, it's terrific. So he's such a celebrity
now. We're just over the horizon.
Yep.
Always.
And the ad takes the piss out of him, and he's happy to have the piss taken out of him. Behind the Curve It's called ironically behind the curve.
That's great. Wait, that's the documentary's called that?
That's the documentary. That's what it's called.
Oh, that's great.
Behind the curve. Anyway, it is funny, especially the ending's just you'll be wetting yourself.
So it's interesting to me. So like reading the historical side of this stuff too, and it's like, you know, a lot of the arguments that were made, they're being made again, right? I mean, like the SpaceX launching their satellite fleet, and obviously we had the Hyper on here as well. That's more industrial kind of, you know, SpaceX is trying to do internet effectively.
Right.
Right. And there's others talking about it too, but it's just, the arguments are just so similar. It's, you know, it's crazy. And it's just I wonder that about, like, you know, like thinking about satellite internet as well, like getting access to that, like the amount of bandwidth you'd get is, you know, if there's anyone out there listening who's working on this kind of thing, give me a shout, Chris at theampower.com.
Yeah, but wouldn't you get more from the new 5G, like a local 5G hotspot?
You're saying with satellite or with a terrestrial-based 5G?
Versus satellite. If you've got 5G, of course, 5G you can't do with satellite because it's only, you know, hundreds of meters range.
Right, exactly, yeah, because it's higher frequencies.
Yeah, but isn't that vastly higher bandwidth that you get from any satellite connection?
Yeah, the idea is you need infrastructure, though. So, like, all the 5G stuff is based around, like, so if you look at, like, the planning documents for 5G, it's like like having every building just kind of coated with transceivers on them.
Yeah, on their roofs, and then they do, you know, 100 to a couple other meters. And the walls,
it's tons of handoff. So
inside, I know, it's nuts.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're going to, I don't know about the US, but they're going to discontinue 3G next year.
Oh, really?
Yep. Wow. They've just announced, Telstra here, which is our main supplier, they've announced that, they're going to discontinue 3G in like less than a year or something. Because they reckon there's only 6% usage at the moment, and it's dropping fast. So only 6% of people are still using 3G. So there you go.
Yeah, I've heard about that kind of thing. They've been talking about, I think I wrote an article about 2G and 3G going away.
Yeah,
And 2G is still. I don't know if you got. Do you guys have any 2G
towers?
No,
it's gone. It went years back. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that at least around here, like a lot of industrial stuff still uses 2G. And there's the only carrier I know of that's using that still offers 2G is T-Mobile.
Oh, and, okay. Right.
3G, there's still AT&T towers, there's still Verizon towers. But yeah, there's a fixed amount of bandwidth, and they want it, so they're going to start shutting that down and repurposing it for other things.
Gobble, basically. They're going to gobble it all up. Yep.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And so that was another interesting thing about the satellite versus, so like at the time, I was talking about this a little bit, like the high-end stuff. I was really surprised, like this is around the time when like GSM hadn't been rolled out at all yet, right? And so there was just no GSM infrastructure. So it was like satellite was the solution.
Yeah, of course.
Versus rolling out
satellite
phones.
Yeah, you had these gigantic satellite phones.
Right. And now GSM is, because it was like, it was so, and you know, this is when I was younger too, so I don't really remember the how this all worked too. But I was reading about, and I talked to my folks about it a little bit, but it was just about like, you know, you had coverage, but mostly you were on your localized, you know, carrier, and there wasn't really as much roaming. Roaming was very expensive, that kind of thing. And so GSM actually allowed actual handoff and better integration between different carriers in different areas.
The problem with satellite is that it's always going to be super ridiculously expensive because there's such a small market for it. Because 99%+ of people live in urban city areas.
Exactly.
Like there's just not enough people out in the fringes, out in the middle of nowhere with no towers that need, you know, they all need something like that, but there's just not enough of them to, you know, make it financially viable, really. So they've got to...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I always, you know, like the economics of how it all works out too is just tough.
And it's always going to be better to transmit to a local tower than it is to transmit to a satellite in terms of like your handheld receiver power and, you know, like size and power and all that sort of stuff. So, local's always going to be better. Anyway.
Yeah, well, this is why I'm studying RF stuff, Dave. This is why
I know. This is why you're getting yourself a spectrum analyzer.
I'm getting a combo, the one that Shariar just reviewed. We'll link that in.
The new Siglent.
That's a good review. So I reached out to Siglent, and they're going to send me a loaner. And I'm excited, too, because I'm going to be be able to test that out. And, you know, it's still a rough, I don't know, Dave, these price points of RF stuff. I was like looking at connectors and stuff.
It's like $3,500 US. Don't get excited that Signal have released a $500 VNA. No. It's like $3,500 starter price, right? Starter price.
Right, right. It goes and that's before all the software upgrades and stuff like that. And there's some cool stuff in there, but it's
cheap still, like compared to the, you know, the same similar performance from other vendors. It's still,
I mean, online I was, there's a document I've talked about on here before that Derek Cozella had shared with me on Twitter. It was basically like pointing out like the old HP 8753. Yeah, boat anchors, right.
Yep.
And they're still, like, those things are still, so the 8753ES is, like, it's got an option built in, so you, it's not just the VNA, it's also got the test set, so, like, the RF relay switching stuff, so you can do S-parameter measurement easily without, like, external setup. And, like, those things are, like, you know, these things are, like, they've got floppy disk drives on them, and they're, $6,000, you know?
Because they're still high-performance instruments. They're just... They were state-of-the-art back in the day, and state-of-the-art back in the day means better than entry-level now. So it's like,
That's a good point.
even 30 years later. So,
Yeah, I mean, what is your preference when you, I mean, like, would you rather take a new, you know, a little shinier version for a similar spec thing? Because, like, both of them are, like, 3 gigahertz max, I think.
Yeah, I would. I'm not a fan, you know, as much as I want to like the boat, and I do like the boat anchors, they're just big and heavy, and I'm always moving stuff around, and it's like...
Oh, true.
You know, it's...
Some of it's just logistics for you.
Because I have different logistics to everyone else. I don't have a fixed setup on my lab bench that, you know, is always just there. It's like I'm always moving stuff around to get stuff in the shot and, you know, things like that. So I've got different requirements. I've got pretty unique requirements. But, the boat anchors are just like... Like, most people don't have a huge amount of bench space. It's like, you know.
Yeah, and especially those things are deep. They're really, really deep.
They're deep, and that's one of the problems, yeah. Yeah. It's just massive amount of space. So,
I remember I had at Keithley, we had another network analyzer. It was just like, it was about, I think it was the same size. I think it was a smaller, different version of the same, like, family. And it just, like, lived on a cart. And, like, that's kind of the best thing, because if you're going to be plugging front or back, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's just, but then you've got... Yeah. A thing rolling around. You almost need like something like come down from the ceiling, you know, like a Batman level style thing.
the best innovation in test instruments was the Tektronix TDS-220 series, which introduced this new modern short depth form factor, you know, bench form factor.
Yeah, but the screen of those things, I mean, like, it was new.
Yeah, I know, but, well, that was state of the art. You probably don't remember when that first came out.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You don't remember that. I've got a video on that when it, like, looking at the ads and a review when it first came out. And it was just, you know,
you're saying that set a new standard for, like,
and
how they
set a new standard to what people expect from the form factor. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, it is true. And it is nice. That part is very nice. I mean, the fact that it can fit on a bench, it doesn't take, you know, a ton of space.
And you can just, move it back an inch or two if you need a bit more room for your notebook or whatever. You know, you can just, like, or shuffle it around if you need to, you know, really easy. But if you've got a boat anchor, that thing ain't moving. You know, you've got to move your work around the instrument.
You literally
can
pull your back. You can throw your back
out. Yeah, yeah. And one of the problems with buying those is shipping. My God, you try and get a shipping quote for anything over 10 kilos or whatever to Australia, and it's like $1,000 for the shipping, for a lot, like a 30 kilo.
That's true. And I think that these things are in such a high demand. The one that I was looking at, it was like such high demand that I was like, Singapore, I'm not, there's like a couple in Singapore. I'm like, no, that's, you know, you have to put it on a slow boat just to afford it, you know,
twice as much
for the shipping as it would for the equipment.
Nuts. Come on, but you live in the land of the, you know, free, home of the brave and home of the cheap test instrument, where there's auctions galore. Where you score this is the close down of big companies like the Motorola Labs and, you know, stuff like that. They're closing down all the time. I advertise them on my website and my forum all the time. There's all these, companies that specialize in, there's one that keeps coming back and paying to advertise on my website because they've got a yet another you know, big lab has closed down and they're auctioning off, you know, and there's dozens and dozens of these spectrum analyzers and VNAs and all sorts of, you know.
I'm just looking on eBay, Dave, honestly.
Oh, like, yeah, you know. No, you've got to be looking at the auction houses. If you're in the US, you have to be following the auction houses because they're just the way to go.
How would one do this?
One goes to the EV blog forum and look at the buy sell section on there, and I and others have published these. You know, there's various like auction. You know, there's dozens of these auction houses. So you go to their website and you can should be able to sign up for new announcements of, you know, latest upcoming auctions and stuff like that. So you'll get notified. Yeah, yeah. So, okay. You know, it's a bit of work. If you want these things, you've got to work for it. You know, it's not going to be given
true.
To you.
I mean, like, yeah, if I wanted it otherwise, right, I would just go and pay more for a...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You go to eBay and you pay a, you know, a definite premium for it.
Yeah, it's a time versus money kind of thing. So that makes sense.
But no, if you're in the US, definitely do it. The problem with the auction houses is that they typically won't... Some will pack and ship for you. They will subcontract a packing and shipping company, but usually, no, it's like you've got to arrange pickup. So either you've got to come pick it up personally or you've got to arrange for a courier to come actually pick it up and pack it and ship it to you.
Right,
or
right.
hand carry
it. And then
it's
on you anyways,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, but no, if you're in California or something like that, there's these auctions all the time.
All right.
Dime a dozen, dude. Seriously, and there's like hundreds of bits of gear. You can equip a state-of-the-art lab for, not going to say next to nothing, but, you know, like 1/20th of the cost of what it would normally cost.
Cents on the dollar.
Yep. So pennies on the dollar, as the Yanks say.
Mm. Yep.
Yep.
That's how we do money.
So do you still have pennies? Do you still like...
We do, but I mean,
nobody,
like, you know.
Right.
I've heard they're trying to get rid of them, but they've said that for years.
Yeah, right.
It's silly.
Anyway, what else are we
speaking of copper, though.
Copper?
Pennies are made out of copper, and I have been cutting copper.
Oh, you've been... you haven't been cutting. Oh, well, is it cutting or milling?
What is milling but cutting?
Milling is cutting. Milling is cutting, isn't it? It's a blade.
Yeah,
it just spins, right?
It just spins, right.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Anyway, you've got a loaner.
Yeah, so
this,
well, we've talked about on the show a lot before, right? Of like the benefits of having a mill locally versus just sending out for a board or something like that.
Yeah.
And I signed up with Bantam. Offered me a mill for a couple weeks. Formerly Other Mill, now Bantam Tools. And so I'm just been cutting out some boards and kind of figuring out what it looks like. People may remember I used to have an actual like. Metal like a mill like a CNC mill, and this is basically a much miniaturized version of it and faster.
So you don't have that mill anymore because you've moved since then, haven't you?
That's right. Yeah, I got rid of that when I moved.
Yep.
So
right.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I, you know, I had actually done a there's a command line tool I did that was like Gerber to G-code or something like that. You know, it was like a tool that basically, you know, that you output Gerbers anyways, but you have to then make the tool paths and. And so I at one point had cut copper clad with, you know, with the mill that I had.
Yep.
But this is like a much different process. It's much more software-y focused. And
does
this is what
software import the Gerber straight and then just goes? Is it that easy or?
Yeah. It's basically, you define the top and or bottom depending on if you're
going to
flip it
drill
over.
As well? Does it drill the holes?
It does, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Right. So you just change the bit or is it like a dual bit? And it spins
around. Yeah, so it changes the bit. It's just got a collet, so you like undo the collet, which is like the way that it tightens down on the tool. Yep. And then each time you insert it, because it doesn't know, you know, the whole thing in milling and CNC in general is you need to know where your tool is in space.
Yeah.
You ever done milling, CNC milling or no?
No.
Okay. The hard thing is like everything's relative, right? And this is kind of like PCB stuff anyways, right?
Yeah, of course.
And the idea is that like, so... You have a Gerber. A Gerber is like a, what is Gerbers? It's like an old format for kind of doing milling, wasn't it? I mean, I don't even know.
Ooh,
I don't know what Gerbers look like
the
on the inside.
I history of it, but anyway.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's some way that they define.
It's a coordinate-based system. You have a reference.
Right.
There's always a reference point.
That's right, yeah.
And
the idea being
everything's
like,
referenced to that.
Right. And so like if you think about like if you just had, say you just had a 0603 resistor, 0603 LED, and then like a connector.
Oh, no, sorry. Sorry, if you want the history of Gerber, I think I've got it. I think it just popped into my memory. Yes, it is for it's for photo plotting, where back in the old day, to actually create the PCB photo plots, you would actually have these wheels with different size holes, different apertures in them, and that would expose the light through, and then you'd have an XY bed. So you'd choose, so the Gerber format would, you would specify which tool, which aperture you're going to use. So you'd specify the aperture, say, I want a 10 thou trace. So it'd select the 10 thou hole. So you'd actually have a hole, and then it would move that around and shine light through, and that would expose. That would expose, and then it'd move on an XY bed. Yeah, apertures. Yeah, and that's where it comes from, because these wheels. So you could only choose traces that were that you had an aperture wheel for. You know, and but that's, you know, 40 plus years ago. It's, you know.
Yeah. It's like one of those things. Like G-code too. G-code has, so basically G-code is the way that you tell a controller where your milling bit is supposed to go in 3D space. Right. And you basically give it commands, G0, G whatever, you know, and then they're just like these commands that then tell it, you know, what to do. And so the idea is, on the back end, what it's doing is basically it takes the Gerbers in, it converts this crazy ass Gerber format, like and then now it's like a bunch of lines, and then it has to then break down each line into a, all right, well, we want to cut this part out of the board.
Yeah.
And so it says, oh, now there's a line going from 35, 37 to 35, 42. Yeah, and so then
it couldn't do curves. It could a curve, it'd break down into little micro steps. So if you had curved traces on your Gerber file, it would translate them into little micro you'd have, 10,000 little elements to make up that one curve.
Right.
You know, kind of thing, because I think it could only do like vector things. So
I
don't know if the Gerber code actually evolved to, have different things, but that's where it comes from. That's where the apertures come from. If you hear the term aperture in related to Gerbers, it's a physical wheel.
G-code has a curve thing, at least.
Right.
I don't know, but I should know this. So now you're like in 3D space, and so again, I'm trying to draw an audio picture, I guess, but like I go and put a drill bit or a milling bit, that's similar things, but they're different. So it's a milling bit, and you put it into this collet, and you don't actually know where the bottom of the drill bit is. You probably know where the, zero, zero is kind of like your bottom left corner of your board.
Yep.
And you might know the height of it, but you need to know all of these different things and where they all stack up. And so what you do instead is then you put this tool in, and then it just does a conductivity test. It goes slowly and touches down on the spoil board, or like the place where the thing is, and that's how it knows where zero, zero is, and then you can kind of stack up from there.
But so you have to do that.
It's free space.
Calibration step before you start.
Every time you switch out a tool, you got to do that.
Every time you switch out a tool, because there might be minor differences. And of course, only like and a 0.1 millimeter height difference would translate into X amount of width error, right?
Yeah, if you're doing like a V groove bit. So like what you're talking about is like if you have a bit that's the one I use is like a 30 degree bit.
Yeah.
And it's, you're trying to just cut with the very, very tip of that thing. It's like a sharpened 30 degree angle. And like you're saying, if you go down further into the material, if you cut further in the material, then then
it goes out wider by the ratio of the angle of the bit. So or if you tell it you've got a 50 degree angle bit and you've only got a 20 degree angle bit, your board's going to be screwed.
So it needs to have all that information kind of encoded in there. So it's really been about just kind of getting the process down. I said, the software is much simpler than it was when I did G-code stuff on my old mill. But then it's about tweaking KiCad or whatever your CAD program is to make a board that actually is friendly for this process, and then actually getting it really, really flat and dialed in. So, and that's what MG, who we've had on the show before as well, he's kind of perfected his process, and that's the one where he's milling off the solder mask. I'm nowhere close to that.
Right.
But I've been bugging him about it, so.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Is it practical for your usage? Is it worth it? Because, you know, you can get a $2 board in five days, you know.
No, no, that's a great question. I mean, I think it's, if I was in a really tight spot, it would be nice to have this around. I'm not usually in a tight spot, but.
Got it.
Yeah. And then I think the other thing is that, like, at least so far, I've only done one-sided boards so far. And let me tell you, that is a challenge. Dave, I challenge you to go and do a board without any vias on it.
Been there, done that, dude.
Yeah. I just mean recently. Have you done it recently?
Oh, no, I haven't done it recently.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. Like, going back, you know, like if you're used to, like, oh, eight-layer boards is where I start, or, you know, like, I'm used to, like, you know, that kind of thing. And then going back to being like, oh, one layer. Oh, God.
Uh-huh.
Can I even do a ground pour here? Like, I don't even know it. You know? And, so just kind of stepping back into that, realm, it's your boards look very different. And and I definitely remember you and I talk about on the show, it's like you'd have to redo your boards to some, when you send them out then too, just because it's a different style. Totally. So
no, that's right.
Right. But it's the fast, the repetition and the speed with which you can make changes, and like there's really, really low, much like getting $2 boards made. It's
although
you can
I
do a lot of
repetition. Think back in the day, I could have made a photo etch board faster than you can make a milled one.
Yeah, that's a good question too.
I could make a board in an hour from go to woe.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Like assuming the artwork's done right, and then I print it out on positive photocopier transparency. Right, so I print out on a laser printer, and it's transparency, and then I expose that on my positive photosensitive exposed board. We're talking, you know, 5 minutes in the, you know, harsh Australian sun, right? And so we're talking 10 minutes up to this point, and then you develop that. It takes 5 minutes to actually develop it, to get off and get rid of all the photo, all the unexposed. No, all the exposed photo resist because it's positive instead of negative. So to get away that, and then another 10 minutes in the etching or something, and Bob's your uncle. And then you drill, you know, it's done. So, I can make a board. I was making boards. Even at work, I would do this at companies I worked for. And I would make boards within an hour or two.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, it's pretty quick.
Yeah, and I think what was the resolution you could get on that too? Like the trace width?
I was doing 8 thou track space. Yeah. You know, it's pretty good. It depends upon the quality of your laser printed things. Often you get little pin marks.
Like focus kind of
often
stuff.
Often you'd have to go touch them up with a little Sharpie. You know, you'd have to like go through, oh, look, there's pinholes, and, you know, I'll just make that one a bit darker, you know, and it was a bit of a trick. And sometimes you'd end up with, you know, spotty traces that had little pit holes in them and stuff like that, but who cares, right? It worked.
I mean, this is just a miniaturization of the fab process, honestly.
Like, totally. You know,
You got double slit effects, and you got to, like, we deal with those too, you know, diffraction and crazy stuff. Yeah.
Anyway, I could make a board in...
Yeah, I think the benefit of that is like the batch processing
benefits.
Versus the rastering, right?
Yeah.
So you could, I think, and like if you needed to make more than one board too, you could do that a lot faster too.
Oh, yeah. Often I would do the panel, and then I'd print out like, you know, five or six boards or something if I needed five or six of them. And then I'd expose them all at once, etch them all at once, do everything, and then just slice them up, slice and dice them once I'm done.
Yeah,
you know the most annoying thing was drilling the bloody holes.
Sure. Yeah, it's and if you had like a milling machine to do that kind of thing, if you could register it and do that kind of thing, that would be like that would probably. And it's surprising that no one has really. I mean, I think I've seen like a Kickstarter for like an agitator, like a chemical bath agitator type of thing. You know,
Yeah, it's important. Yeah, no, I'd just stand there and shake it. You know, I'd just stand there and continually agitate.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
I just mean that like someone tried to make that into a consumer product, or not consumer, but you know, a prosumer product type of thing. And I don't know. It's interesting that there's not, you know, like the milling is something, and I think the combination between the two would be nice too, but.
But unfortunately, the cheap PCB, modern cheap PCB market's just killed it. I mean, killed all demand for that. There's just no point in trying to do a Kickstarter for a PCB all-in-one agitator, or, you know, manufacturer milling machine or something like that. You know, it's like, yeah, the market's just so small. It's the same thing with the satellite phones. You know, the market's just
right,
not
right. Exactly. It's just a really no. You're totally right. And so like someone asked me about, and I've seen on Twitter too. Someone asked about like the Dragonfly. That's another type of printer that's out there.
So
it's a 3D printer that's like can do like conductive traces and stuff like that.
Conductive inks,
yeah, right. Yeah, but it actually builds the entire board, right? Yeah. So it doesn't just do a conductive like a. It's not just the board. You're actually doing like the layers are kind of interwoven, and so in that case, I think that you could do like a 4 or 6 layer board in a couple hours. You know, like and actually have it on site.
Yeah.
And but that thing's like industrial equipment, like tens of thousands of dollars, like very, very nice looking thing.
Yeah.
And the only thing, the only reason I could think of doing that is like, cause you could literally do, you know, a 6 layer board in-house in a couple hours.
In hours. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So like, and so then the market for that is military company, you know, like someone who, you
don't
want to send it out.
Send
you know?
Their IP outside. Yeah. So it's the, you know, the CIA and the, you know, other military and other paranoid companies who don't want to send their IP out to some Chinese.
Or you just have like really quick turn needs too. You know, like that could make sense then. But like at that point, you're just monster company type of things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is interesting how the cheapo market kind of impacts things. Even my own behavior, you know, like how I do boards these days too. It's really
you
just shipping
build
that takes a long time.
Into your process, you know, okay, well, it's going to take me 4 days to get this board, and I can, if I need it quicker, I can pay for express, you know.
Yeah,
but even the $2 boards, I'm getting in 5 days, you know. It's like, wow.
Right.
You know, and rarely do your needs, you know, as I said, if you want it faster, you can actually pay for, you know, crisis express courier thing. Option, right?
I,
so you can pay
10
times
that,
the cost of, well, usually it's a checkout option or whatever, you know. They'll go, okay, do you want the slower one or do you want the super crisis, you know, courier option?
Yeah.
And, you know, and, but even then, you just build that into your design and prototyping process, right? I've got 3 days to wait for my board or something. Whoop de doo, you know, I'll work on something else. I'll work on the firmware and then it'll be ready by the time the boards get here.
Right,
kind of thing. It's one of those, you know, R&D flows things.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yep.
Mm.
Yeah. So, I'm hoping to piece my two things together, cut out some antennas sometime soon, and
sweet.
It seems like that's a good crossover. We'll see how that goes.
Excellent.
But, yeah, there's actually a really good app note about that. Did I ever talk about that on the show? There's a TI app note that just shows off all of the different, like all of the recommended antennas.
Oh, okay.
Different antenna shapes and stuff like that. Let me see if I
can
find this real
quick.
Yeah, it's neat. It's because you literally then go and look at some of their dev boards. You're like, oh yeah, they just did that.
Yeah. Nice.
Not sure if I can.
Yeah, because that's not something your Joe average person laying out a board would know. It's like, oh, okay, I've got this Bluetooth thing. You just, you know, how do I do a Bluetooth antenna? I don't know. How do I do a GSM antenna? I don't know.
Right.
Well, you just follow the app note, you know, like you just do it exactly the same.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So, yep. No, you don't go to the end.
It's ANO58, if you want to look that up.
Page
antenna
turner.
Selection guide. Yeah, so it's cool. It's cool to see all the testing they do, and they have like a dev board where they can break it out, pigtails, and all the different things. So it's a nice resource.
Got it.
ANO58.
Yep, I'm having a look at that now. Oh yeah, sweet. Yeah. Oh wow, that's pretty comprehensive. Oh geez. Oh brief antenna theory. Oh wow. Yeah, someone's gone to town.
Yeah.
Somebody had fun. Geez, is that Richard Wallace had fun. Good on you, Richard. Good on you, Dick.
Yep.
All right, fantastic. all right. What else we got on this week's show?
Well, I was going to ask you, what you building these days? How's your, let's get a little update here on the
U-supply. The micro-supply update. The micro-supply update is more USB. We've gotten over HID hurdles. We've gotten over hurdles, and now it's USB PD. It's the power delivery thing.
Oh,
And apparently, and you know, David's working on this, and he's had to contact Richtek, who's the chip manufacturer, right? And there's apparently, there are like secret, there's these undocumented registers that do all the magic. And it's like they won't, and you know, you have to sign, like contact them to get the secret squirrel list of registers and how they work. Like, and you, you've got to promise not to give it to anyone else. And it's like, you know, like, what?
And Dave will now recite them on the live on the air. Of,
yeah. Like seriously, he's looking at this code that he got. You know, there's somebody's opened some code for this chip or whatever. And he's going, these like, it's right into these registers that aren't documented. And he's like, you know, and he's debugging all this, and he's going, I have no idea what these registers do. So he has to contact the manufacturer, and sure enough, they get back to him fast enough, and they go, oh, yeah, here's the secret squirrel information, you know, here's the secret handshake. And yeah, like, geez, give me a break. Anyway, there are different ways to do Microsoft. Why am I saying Microsoft? USB. PD, which is power delivery standard. It's really quite complex. We've talked about this before, which is why a lot of products don't use USB PD, is because the development time and effort is quite complex to meet the standard and everything, and to actually do it right. And there's two ways to do it. One is using we're using ST processor on the on the USB side, as well as a Richtek part, and you ST do actually have a USB PD library, right? So they do actually have it, but it takes over 32K apparently compiled just for the library, right? Wow. Yeah, it's a they don't like to optimize their code, let's say that. Yeah, and and so if you want to use that, so if you want the advantages of having that shorter development time, you've got to pay an extra $2 for your microcontroller, because you've got to go to, you know, way up the chain. Yeah, you got to get a 256K micro, you know, something like that. Yeah, it's killer. It's killer. Yeah. And then they also make a pairing chip as well, which communicates via I2C to the micro, and it handles the USB power delivery, you know, protocols and negotiation and all that sort of jazz.
Got it. And it just hangs off the lines, or what does it do?
Yeah, it just hangs off, and it goes through that to the micro. Or something, and it communicates via I2C, and it's just it's a mess. It's a mess.
It doesn't sound very elegant.
No, USB PD is one of the biggest pain in the asses. So if you think you're going to be able to develop a USB PD product quickly, think again.
You guys already have transceivers, like USB transceivers built into this. You picked a processor with that built in.
Yeah, they're built in, but this is implementing the, you know, talking properly the USB PD protocol and actually doing the power negotiation and all that sort of jazz. And there's so much involved.
So doesn't that mean that you basically could have, like, not even, you wouldn't even need the D plus D minus on your processor then, right?
Well, we do, because we're sending data as well. We're sending serial data as well. We're implementing a serial protocol over the USB, but we're also negotiating for the USB power.
Too. So the I2C chip only handles on the power line. It doesn't do. Does it actually talk? Does it inject like data packets on the D plus D minus as well?
Yes, I believe it does.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So yeah. Oh, anyway, okay. I'd have to call up the schematic and everything to.
Yeah. No worries.
Verify, it's like. It's not easy. It's a real pain in the butt.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway, it's not that bad. He's getting a hold of it. Once he got those registers and figured out what's going on, it's like, okay, we're back on track.
Yeah, it's like having the Rosetta Stone at that point,
right? Yeah, exactly. But the fact that you have to do that and it's just it's not documented is just scary, really. So... as we said, there are easier ways, but you pay for that. And then there's a trade-off. Do you pay $2 more for your product in your BOM cost forever, right? Because you've got to build that part in. You might sell 1 million widgets, right? Or do you take the hit in the development cost to develop your own on a smaller, you know, to roll your own solution on a smaller, cheaper micro? And you've got to trade that off, you know, how much development time is worth and how many units you're going to sell.
And then your code might branch from theirs and you'd have to, like, keep an eye on it. And, that's tough.
And stuff like that, And how fast you want to get to market and, you know, how many people you've got to work on. It's like
the cost of diverging from the dev kit almost.
exactly. And it's, I had not, if I, seriously, if I had if I knew how much effort all this USB stuff would have been, I would have, you know, like way back at the start, I would have gone, oh, no, look, I'll just go for some other solution somehow.
Right, you know?
It was just...
Barrel jacket is.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. It's like, yep. Yeah, it's a pain. But now you're so far down the rabbit hole, you can't stop. You know, we have to see it through, you know, so... Yeah. And we're almost there. Like, it's, you know, it's getting pretty close. Like, we've come over, you know, multiple huge hurdles. And
Yeah.
So, anyway.
You can do it, man. This is interesting, too, like, hearing about the, you know, the firmware versus the hardware. You know, the hardware's been done for
six months, you know. Yeah. And it's been six months or something of just, like, firmware hurdles and stuff like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You might think, oh, it's just a power supply that talks over USB. No, it ain't that easy, I'm afraid. So
right.
Yep. Hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting how that all works out.
Yep. Nasty.
So you mentioned the STM32. I had a thing on this on the list from this week. At first, like, I was reading this press release, and it was from Seed Studio, right? So Seed Studio is putting out this new little widgety thing called the Wild Light. Yep, that's they do that. And I'm like, I'm reading it, and it says Wild Light RISC-V, right? And I'm like, what am I looking at here? And I like, so I'm looking at this thing, and it's got an ESP8266. And first off, it's cheap; it's $7, right? So super cheap. It's got a ESP8266 on it. And then it's got an STM32 on it. Well, it's actually got the Giga devices, which is that processor we mentioned on here before, right? So that's the one that's the complete register match. For the STM32, right? So Giga devices F103, right? So that's meant to match the STM32 F103. And so I'm looking at this thing, and I'm just like, I literally can't figure out. I'm like, is it the Wi-Fi thing that's different? I'm like, no, that's an ESP. And like back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And like, so what I realized is that Giga Devices decided it was a smart idea to make a completely different architecture part by changing one letter. So GD32 is Giga Devices 32, VF103.
All right.
The STM32 clone version is GD32F103. And so it's just that V in there. And now instead of being an ARM device, it's a RISC-V. It's a RISC-V device. It's like,
oh,
holy
God.
Shit.
What?
Yeah. Like, this so is like, insane. I just imagine that, you know, a couple people are going to be like, I can't get anything to compile for this thing. It doesn't work. It doesn't work.
I'm sure I ordered the right part. Look at the part number.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
So, but the other interesting thing here is that the Giga Devices is making a RISC-V part that's going, it's already out in the market. So it's the Bumblebee core. And RISC-V is out there, man. I mean, it's been out there, but it's, you know, more and more silicon that's kind of hitting the real world. So it's very exciting.
And what is the driver? What is the need for RISC-V? Because you don't pay the ARM royalties. Is
that's
that
right.
one of
yep.
the one of that's yep. one of the major?
Well, and so
is that the major driver? The major driver, or
the thing that we've gotten wrong in the past that we need to make sure we make clear here. RISC-V is an ISA, which is instruction set architecture, right? So it's actually not a processor. Someone made a processor that was conforming to that ISA. In this case, it's the Bumblebee core, right? But I don't know anything about that.
But now you can effectively say it's a processor core, pretty much. Like,
yeah, I guess in the same way you might say something is ARM, right?
Yeah, I don't think you're going to stop people thinking that and saying that. It's just, you know, it's
yeah,
just
I think the equivalent would be like the Bumblebee core would be like being a Cortex M0. That's like the core.
Right.
But it's still an ARM architecture processor, right? So this would be a RISC-V ARM architecture processor. So that's kind of how I think about it. I don't know if that's right, but that's how I think about it at least.
Yeah.
It's interesting that it's out there because, like you said, it's the you know they're not charging royalties on it. There's a lot more room for improvement, and this leads into another story that we have on the thing this week. Which before the show you said, well, why do we care about this? It's actually driving ARM's behavior too. So one of the things we have on the show this week is ARM enables custom instructions for embedded CPUs. You better bet your bottom dollar that that's coming from the fact that you can just go and make your own processor now, right? They're basically being like, oh, you wanted custom? We didn't know. Now you can be custom too, right? And I'm not really sure the logistics of it because I assume it's like you have to be at the stage where you're developing your own chips, you're buying a core and you're paying royalties. I think you actually don't pay for the core anymore either. You just pay royalties.
Oh, yeah. Well, so, no, that's always been the case. I thought you paid for a royalty. Wait, if
you're
a chip manufacturer.
You always pay the royalty for sure. But yeah. I'm pretty sure that you used to have to pay an upfront fee as well to get access to
that. Oh, okay, right. Okay.
Yeah. So it was like a big chunk of money up front and then royalty stuff. I think they're moving to a royalty only because if you say, hey, it's going to be $300,000 to get started, or you can just go and get one of these free cores over here, some people are going to make that differentiation.
That's it.
Yeah. So it's going to be very interesting seeing, first off, hopefully ARM continues to play nice. They had a little bit of a smear campaign. Nah, just mini smear.
Mini smear.
Just like a mini bagel schmear versus... I think, it's going to continue to get more interesting. And I think there's still benefits, too. ARM is doing interesting things with, like, the embed. That's, like, their real-time OS. And
We've been talking about, RISC V, RISC V. Is it RISC V or RISC V?
It's RISC V, yeah.
RISC V. Everyone, we've been talking about RISC V and everyone's talking about it. But that's only in our sphere, right?
Yeah.
That's like
we don't matter.
out in the real world, it's like how much penetration is RISC V getting in the, industrial consumer market. Right, probably.
Yeah, that's going to have
order
some lag,
zero so far. Yeah, there's going to be huge.
Yeah, I think so. And and the fact being that, like, okay, so you and I both say, or how about this? So Microsupply comes out tomorrow, and you're like, all right, I'm going to start on the next version of the Microsupply. I'm going to use a RISC V processor, and it's like the amount of chips that you can buy off the shelf, which you've always said that if it doesn't exist unless you can buy it on DigiKey, which
that's right,
is a good guideline, I think, at least from a product perspective. Yep. It's very, very small. And so it's growing. You can go buy a gig. I think this might be early silicon, the Giga Devices one.
Oh, okay.
But
right.
That's not the only one that's out there. And you can always go buy a FPGA and you could drop this on there too, right? There's lots
of
people.
Of course. You could actually roll your own kind of
right.
thing. Yeah.
Right.
But once again, it's the same thing we talked about with USB PD. Do you roll your own or do you go with a solution that's physically more expensive?
Right.
Because it's a
shorter
development
time. Engineering trade-offs,
right,
of cost and risk and time and power.
Risk.
Power being a big one too, right? Not risk, yeah. Nice. Yeah.
We're here all week, folks.
That's right. Try the wheel. I think that it's a trade-off, right? And I think right now it's not that, but I think what we're going to continue to see as people continue to listen to the Amp Hour for the rest of their lives, of course, is that we're just going to, hey, this new part's on a DigiKey or a Mouser or an Arrow or whatever, and you can just go buy it. Or, hey, TI decided to drop this core as an experiment into their thing. It's not unheard of that, even a Microchip, which is on, MIPS for all those years, then they have a... they have an ARM processor too, and a bunch of them.
Yeah,
right.
Well, only because they bought it via Atmel. Yeah, they bought Atmel, and then the ARM came over with it.
No, it was before that. Actually, it was.
Oh, was it?
Who was
okay.
That? Luminary.
Really?
Luminary Micro. That's
oh,
who it was.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. Oh wait, was that TI?
Eh.
Who cares? It doesn't matter.
Anyway, this whole part number thing that you were talking about, right? Part number ambiguation. The video I just released 10 minutes before we recorded this I tore apart one of these lead light drivers, right? Constant current lead light drivers, and it's using a cheap Wanhung Low brand chip on there. And I was able to find the data sheet for the exact part number, but it was marked confidential. It wasn't on the manufacturer's website, right? The chip manufacturer.
Wait, how'd you find it?
Well, I Googled.
The dark web.
Data
hacker.
The dark web. Yeah, I went to the dark web. Psst, buddy. Hey, have you got
this?
Want
to buy a data sheet?
Right. Anyway, so the company is Onbright, who you might never have heard of. Anyway, they make these lead controller drivers that are in all these Chinese, lead driver things for your lights. Anyway, so I found the exact part number, and then I was making it. I go, well, beauty. So I started recording my video, and I was going through it. I was recording, blah, blah, going through the data sheet, and then I realized this isn't the right part. Even though the part number is exact, it's a different
Playing
package.
Loosey-goosey with the part names, huh?
Yeah. and it was like, and it was like an S, it was a six-pin SOT 23 instead of a DIP 8, which is what I had. But the part number was identical, and this one that I had the data sheet for used an external driver transistor, where and then I had to go back and check my board. No, there's no external driver transistor.
You had to take like, crazy pills.
I know. I was like, and you can see this in the video, and it's just
yeah,
like that's exactly the same part number.
Yeah, I think maybe, and maybe this is part is just because it's low cost stuff. But like, I also wonder. I remember like in Bunny's articles about Shanzai phone. Is that what it is? Shanzai? Remember the phones article that Bunny did many years ago?
Yeah.
About like how there's like the kind of copy culture and stuff like that.
Yes.
And I just wondered the same thing where it's like, well, we're trying to make a cross and it's pretty close, and you'd have to kind of just test if it is actually the exact same part, you know?
Right. Well, I wonder if this company just like rolled this custom variant that had the inbuilt power transistor and they didn't even bother releasing a data sheet for it. They just went, some company approached them with an order. Oh, I want, 500,000 of these chips, but I'd love if it had a built-in power transistor. Oh, yeah, we can do that in a DIP 8 package and just whack a power transistor on there. And they just did it and just didn't bother to, actually release a data sheet for it. Maybe there is, but they just kept the same part number. And it's like, what?
Yeah, so that would be interesting if you could like test the various. I mean, because the pins would add up in that case, right?
It was the same except it had
the
building.
The function was the same, pretty much.
Yeah. The function was absolutely identical. Yeah. Except it had the built-in power transistor.
There was no mention
transistor.
Of like alt packages on the bottom of
the
data sheet.
No, there was no in the data sheet. No mention of alternative packages. It was it was simply that. Yeah. Mm. So I nuts.
Yeah, anyway. I haven't had a chance to watch the video yet. I'm sorry, but release it right before, so I have an excuse this time.
Yep.
Yeah.
But yeah, that just reminded me of that
it's tricky. I mean, I think especially markings on their own are tough, but then you're sometimes you have markings that are like kind of hard to discern what they're doing there. But then if the parts are exactly the same, it's like, oh man, that's tough to do. So
crazy. Anyway, didn't cause me any drama because I just got the function. Yeah, functionally, it was the same. So it worked for my purposes. But anyway.
I made some videos for the first time in a while.
No.
I did, yeah. Getting a Blinky.
For your course? Yeah, another Getting a Blinky?
Yeah, 5.0.
Or is it a follow-up?
It's the software is now on.
Didn't we mention? Oh no, we forgot to mention it the other week. That's right.
We did, yeah.
We did. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It's the exact same thing. People are like, "Why did you add like mounting holes or do anything different?" I'm like, "Well, it's just it doesn't. I should have. Yeah.
Because they keep changing KiCad the way it works, right? So old videos are completely obsolete. Are you going to actually remove the old videos, or are you?
I link them and I unlist them. I don't like break the link or anything like that. But I definitely put notes that this is not the video you want.
Sure. Yep. These are not the droids you're looking for.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. It's tough too because and someone had complained about it too. It's like there is a lot of old, crufty documentation on the internet. When software moves that, and there's no one really like controlling it. It's basically Google's in charge. Yeah. So you have to kind of search for KiCad 5.0 and then like. Sometimes I'll add 2019 to make sure it's not an old issue from 2015 that's been fixed,
Well, maybe I should do that to old videos because I still get, emails. Oh, I watched your multimeter shootout and, is this still the best one? Dude, that video was 9 years ago.
That's right. Yeah.
And it was
Yeah, it makes me wish you could do more like a picture in picture. Be like, "Hello, welcome to this video from 9 years ago. By the way, there's an updated video. Don't take. This is for historical purposes only.
Yeah,
It's tough to do. But that's
update the title and the description of that. Some old videos that aren't relevant anymore. But I got 1,500 videos. So
of course. It's tough. I tried it. Yeah. You could do is you could just do if you appended the year. Onto all of the videos, that might just be enough of an indicator. Because that would be people would be like, "Oh, 2009."
Right. I might do that for all new review shootout videos. I might embed the year in the thumbnail or something 2019 shootout.
How's this going to work in like 20 years when there's all this, there's even more cruft on the internet?
Right.
It's just like, oh yeah, well, I watched a video of a guy that's not been around doing videos for the past 20 years, but...
Are you saying I'm going out of business? Is that
I even avoided. I was going to say someone died. I didn't want to. That sounded really bad.
I was kind of getting that vibe, but I thought,
No, I just mean, Dave, what I'm trying to say is you're so successful, you'd retire and, not make videos anymore.
Yeah, of course, I've probably got a good 20 years left in me before.
Oh, yeah. The grayness in your beard is, first off, you got to grow the beard, and then the beard's got to turn gray.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah,
it's a real problem. Like old content,
Sure. Yeah, it's Google will help you find just anything, just about anything you want, including a $17 bench supply.
Yeah, I was perplexed by this because it's on DigiKey's website, and I clicked the link before the show, and it's like, what? Are DigiKey selling a $17 bench supply? Yeah. And just went, no, they can't possibly. And sure enough, they aren't. But it was one of the staffers, Rick W. at, I presume he's a staffer there.
Yeah, and, at least a writer. On their blog.
And he's done an extensive review and tear down of this $17. Where'd he get it from? Does he mention it?
I don't. I think probably like an eBay or an Alibaba or something like that. But
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But $17 for a bench supply. Yeah, it's crusty as, right? It's a piece of folded sheet metal with the cheapest one hung low transformer you can get
it's
still,
basically a transformer but it's got like a display on it. It's got knobs. Potentiometers aren't cheap.
Knobs.
Mounting plates. I just mean mechanical stuff always adds up.
Right. Yeah, it does.
Then someone's got to, when it's like a through hole thing, then someone's got to put it together.
Well, that's the video that I did and released this morning, once again with that lead driver, right? I tore down two different lead drivers. One was a bottom of the barrel one, which flickers, right? And the reason it flickers is because they've cut cost, right?
Munsing.
And when I tore it down, right? And sure enough, they solder the wires directly onto the board. You know how these little, you've used these little lead light controller, right? Usually they have screw terminals at the end, but they didn't bother because they cost money, right? They cost a couple of cents extra.
That's right.
So they, so that even in a huge volume, they cost a couple of cents extra. So they know the mains wires soldered straight in, the output wires soldered straight in, none of these, even though the case had the holes for the screw terminals, right? It had the holes to put your screwdriver in, right? They just know. This was their ultra cheap version.
I've been interested in that before with I've seen... I think it was my cheapo hot air station, bought.
Right.
And I'm like, why doesn't this thing have an IEC connector on it? And I wanted to just be able to swap out, pull the plug on it. It costs money and it's probably safer that way.
Yeah, right.
They take the safest thing they could do and they do the opposite. this thing was real cheap. And they're like 40 bucks now. Oh my God, they're so cheap. It's crazy.
Yeah. It's amazing that you can get $17 for a bench supply. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, right.
And does that include delivery? Surely not.
I don't think so.
Okay, because they're fairly heavy, right?
Oh, we should follow up on your thing from last week. If people haven't watched the video from your last week, that was a DMM / a field. What was it called? A field tester or something?
Oh, the process meter.
Process meter, okay.
Yeah, process. American.
Sorry, process meter. Yeah.
Process meter, right? Yeah. And,
was immediately, gone, but it was...
It was immediately gone, but there are reports that people have been receiving them. But there are tons of reports of the sellers just came back and said, sorry, we can't deliver this. Would you like this $2 cheapie instead? It's the best seller, trust us.
Right,
and it's like,
you're looking to measure some mains voltage? This will do you fine, sir.
Some people have been getting them, but the many sellers on there pulled it within hours of the video. There was just such demand and they went, holy shit, there's a run on the bank. And they all panicked. Yep. So I can just picture them at the Shenzhen market, because a lot of these, if you don't know, a lot of these AliExpress stores actually just are a little stand at the Shenzhen market or somewhere.
That's right.
Something like that. So I can picture them all, shouting across the corridors, there's a run on these meters,
EV-blogged.
often they won't carry the stock themselves. They'll say, I've got 300 in stock, but they won't carry it. So if they get an order, they will just walk around the corner to the next store that has the stock and they'll buy it from them and then then they'll ship it to you from their stand, And that's how it works. And they all just shut it down. They all shut up within hours. You can watch them try. And people were watching this at, like in real time as all these stores just, you know, vanished. They all suddenly shut down their listings within hours of each other. It was hilarious.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, some people are getting them. Some people got lucky. So there was probably, you know, a stock of 100 out there or something. And
a true stock. Factory seconds or like a
factory seconds or something and fell off the truck or whatever. Yeah. We still don't know the story. So anyway, it was that video was hugely. People love a bargain, you know. It's
$9 then it becomes a collector's item too. Yeah, you exactly.
Know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hey, I got one. It's like one of these badges of honor. I was in so quick that I.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. And it's like, these cheap power supplies. I don't know what to think. Like, well, you know.
There is a high frequency output at the bottom. It's for a linear supply. Like linear supplies, like it's really just about having like a clean transformer and
exactly.
Some big caps, you know. Like
is there high frequency stuff? Why is there high frequency stuff? It's just a linear.
I'm guessing it's probably bleeding in from the.
That could be just common mode noise. That could be measurement.
12 megahertz
issues.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, this thing does not seem like it's very...
right through your transformer.
Yeah,
that stuff just goes straight through the AC coupling, you know.
Yeah.
And, I've done a video on that somewhere. But, yeah, I mean, like for $17 for just somebody setting up a cheap-ass, you know, lab.
Right,
it's
right.
Like, you know. They did go to the effort to put the red sealer on the connectors. I'm impressed.
Yeah.
You know, so they don't actually vibrate loose when you know there's the sealer, the thread, not thread locker, but you know, glue kind of.
Right. Yep.
Red stuff, red gun.
Have you ever done someone's done a lab for under a certain amount of dollars? Was that you?
Me.
That did that?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's me. And once again, a year later, it's completely out of date. I keep getting
it's tough.
People.
Right.
You know, please do a new one because everything's, you know, out of date. Mm. Some things aren't, but. Others are. So, yeah, those things have to be done yearly, really.
Yeah.
It's,
well, there you go, Dave. There's your idea for video today.
I know. Yeah. The future of the EV blog is just...
Yeah.
Yep. That's the future of the EV blog, just, you know, updated
the wire cutter for the discerning electronics nerd.
Yep. It's just, it's crazy. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. People love cheap test gear and cheap stuff, you know, bargains. It's just every time I do a video like that, it's massively popular. I should, if I was a smart YouTuber, that's the only content I'd be putting out.
The Dave branded version, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's why, you know, Clive is popular. Big Clive, you know, because he like just all he does is his whole channel is just tearing down this cheap Chinese shit.
Yeah,
and it's just funny, you know.
Yeah, I think that's it's you get lowest common denominator, right? Everybody can afford to buy it, and then
exactly.
It's interesting to see when there's some cool tips in there too. Yeah.
Yep. Even your pros, you know, like half of my audience are engineering,
of course,
professionals, right? But even they like. You know,
well, that's the thing, Dave. We're all cheapskates, so there is that.
Yeah, exactly. We're engineers by definition. We're cheapskates.
Right. We can double the amount of stuff we get if we get half the price. So
I could mention how I was literally diagnosed the other week as being a tight ass.
Really? How's that? Did a doctor do this?
physio. I went to my physio for a knee problem. And I came away saying, nope, I'm literally a tight ass. My glutes are so tight that it's causing knee problems. Seriously. So I've got to, every time before my gym class now, I've got to roll a tennis ball around my bum. I've got to loosen my, otherwise I get knee problems. Yeah.
Oh, man. You should do a lacrosse ball and then you'd start weeping like a child. That's the worst thing. Have you ever done a lacrosse ball before? Like the rubber ball?
Dude, like we don't even know what lacrosse here is.
Well, anyways,
I know it's some
yeah.
sort of hockey variant.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It's a hockey type thing.
I used to be an athlete, so I used to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you ever roll out a muscle with a lacrosse ball, it's like hard rubber. And like you'll start crying. It's like, oh, it's terrible.
Yep.
Oh, God.
Yep.
So certified tight ass.
I am literally diagnosed tight ass. Yeah,
that's great. That's
love
great.
I know. So I'm telling everyone. It's absolutely hilarious.
Yep. Should make a T-shirt.
Yeah.
Maybe
literal
not.
Tight ass. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, that's great. Anyway, we're way over time. Do we have anything last minute?
I don't
this one went quick.
Think so. There's stuff on the.
There is.
Subreddit. Check it out. Yeah, oh, that's the last thing. We are going to be I'll have already announced this at the beginning of the episode, but we're doing our quasi-annual survey, and there will be some prizes.
Where the hell are we getting prizes from?
From you. Some old school DMMs that were sent to me will be in the offering. Notebooks,
right.
And some Digilint Analog Discovery 2s, and we'll see what else we can dig up. So
Discovery 2s, they're worth a pretty penny.
They're worth they're like $200. So I had been gifted those by Digilint. They were very very kind about that. And
excellent. Well done.
So talk about free stuff. There we go.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah. And we'll see what else we have kicking around. But if you're interested, you definitely have to put in your email address in order to win. I'm not going
to
use it for any other
thing. We have to be able to contact you. No, yeah. I'm sick of doing contests and somebody wins and then I can't contact them. It's like, God.
Make sure it's a good email address. So I won't use it for anything else.
Trust us.
Yeah, we're too lazy to do that. Come on.
We're just,
Marketing, what's that? Oh, boy.
Yep.
All right, fill out the survey, and we'd love to hear from you.
Cool.
They were really good comments last time, too. Thanks for doing it. Whoever did it last time,
it's
thank
great.
You for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I hate Dave. I hate Chris. It's like,
That's fine.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. We read all the comments.
All right, Dave. We'll talk to you soon.
Catch you next time.
See ya.